Hello and welcome to the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association's Ask the Expert podcast series. This episode is titled Open Q&A on Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorder, or NMOSD. My name is Christy Dilger, and I will moderate this episode. Today, I am pleased to be joined by Dr. Elena Grebensikova. Dr. Grebensikova is an assistant professor of neurology and neurological infections at Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, where she also runs the Transverse Myelitis Center. You can view her full bio in the podcast description. SRNA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at wearesrna.org. This episode is made possible in part by the generous support of Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, and Genentech. To start us off, Dr. G, can you begin by briefly explaining what neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder is?
Yes, of course. Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for inviting me. So neuromyelitis optica is an autoimmune disease in which immune system makes a mistake and produces a protein called antibody to aquaporin 4 receptor. That receptor is ubiquitous in the central nervous system, in the optic nerves, the spinal cord, and throughout the brain. And so when the immune system erroneously creates this protein, this antibody circulates by blood throughout the brain, optic nerve, and spinal cord, and it activates immune system to go and attack those areas where that receptor is expressed. And people develop variable symptoms. Some people develop inflammation of the optic nerve, sometimes on both sides, sometimes on one side, which causes blurry vision that can be quite severe, often with pain behind the eye, sometimes without pain or minimal pain. People can experience transverse myelitis or inflammation of the spinal cord, in which people typically over a course of hours to several days lose strength, sensation, and often it affects their bladder and bowels as well, and can also cause severe nerve-related pain in the aftermath, including spasms. Other presentations include intractable hiccups or with nausea, vomiting. So that is one of the key presentations of neuromyelitis optica that is sometimes being overlooked. So if you are having intractable hiccups, not just something for 20 or 30 minutes, that could be a sign of relapse and your physician needs to know about it. Otherwise, things like what we call brainstem syndromes, where a person develops trouble with speech or double vision or other cranial nerve deficits where their eyes don't move together or they develop nystagmus. Some people with neuromyelitis optica also can have lesions in the cerebellum, in the balance center of the brain. And that is something that has been recently highlighted in the updates for the international criteria of neuromyelitis optica diagnosis.
Great. Thank you for that overview. So you mentioned the immune system plays a big part in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. But can you give us any more details on what exactly causes NMOSD?
Yeah, so clearly something triggers the immune system to make that mistake, all right? But to date, we do not know what is the inciting agent, right? There isn't a specific virus or a specific behavior that does that sort of a trigger. We know that people with a rheumatological disease, a lupus, systemic lupus erythematosus, seem to be more likely to develop neuromyelitis optica. And we actually do not yet understand why that is. It is possible that genetically, people who are more prone to develop a certain autoimmune disease cluster together, such as lupus and neuromyelitis optica. So that's one mild, something we noticed. The second thing is infections, right? So infections, they stimulate immune system, but all of us have infections since we are children and not everybody develops autoimmune disease. But we do see that often people who present with neuromyelitis optica, they present shortly after some sort of an infection, maybe a viral infection or a urinary tract infection in some instances. And it's not to say that specific infections cause neuromyelitis optica, but it appears that for some people who are immunogenetically predisposed to their immune system making mistakes, sometimes an infection that activates immune system creates a canvas for the immune system to make that mistake, and that mistake arises and an antibody is formed, and then it goes and activates immune system to do that damage. But to answer the question more directly, I would say one is that to date, we do not have any evidence to suggest that neuromyelitis optica is definitively a genetic disorder. While there may be some propensities, there isn't such a thing as mom transmission of NMO to the child or so on. And then there isn't a specific virus that has been shown to definitively cause neuromyelitis optica, or nor is there a certain bacterium or a vaccine to cause it. So we do believe that most autoimmune diseases, just like neuromyelitis optica, are multifactorial, where immune system makes a mistake under a set of circumstances. And those circumstances could be A, somebody with a very specific immune type, what we call phenotype, or a person who maybe whose immune system is a little bit more prone to making mistakes, right? So we all have different propensities to autoimmunity. For example, women have higher propensity to autoimmune diseases than men for a lot of autoimmune diseases. So our hormones have an effect on that as well. And two, there are likely environmental hits and some viral hits that contribute to dysregulation of the immune system. But we currently do not have data to suggest that one specific inciting agent, whether it is environmental chemical or a medication or a virus or a bacterium, that it is solely sufficient to cause the disease itself.
Got it. That's very interesting. And hopefully in the future we can learn more about this, but that's a great explanation. So moving on, one thing that I know has hopefully improved over the years, but it still seems to be a concern, is diagnosis of NMOSD. And some people, it takes a really long time to get diagnosed, and for some people, it's right away the first day that they're admitted. But can you talk about how NMOSD is diagnosed from someone coming in to the hospital presenting with certain symptoms, and how that kind of process goes along, and what kind of doctors see them, and what kind of tests are run?
For sure. Yes, indeed, over the years, so many patients were initially misdiagnosed historically as multiple sclerosis, and then later it became evident that they are anti-aquaporin 4 antibody positive and they actually have neuromyelitis optica. So historically, that was an issue for several decades, essentially. But I do think that this has improved dramatically, because now when a patient presents with symptoms such as blurry vision or transverse myelitis, so they have weakness in the arms or legs or both, numbness, tingling, etc., or they present with intractable hiccups, people are thinking more about the differential diagnosis. They are now not thinking about MS alone, but they're thinking about mimics such as neuromyelitis optica, MOG-associated demyelination, also known as MOGAD. And there is very specific, highly specific testing that's available for that. So the typical diagnosis occurs when a patient presents with symptoms that are concerning for demyelinating disease or astrocytopathy in the instance of a neuromyelitis optica. So maybe they have blurry vision or double vision, or they have transverse myelitis, or they have intractable hiccups. So the next stage is that doctors get an MRI and they evaluate to see if there's a lesion on the MRI that is compatible with what we see in neuromyelitis optica. And lesions in neuromyelitis optica often are very different than what they look like in multiple sclerosis. So for example, lesions in the spinal cord in neuromyelitis optica are typically what we call longitudinally extensive, spanning 3 segments of the spinal cord or even longer, sometimes lighting up the entire spinal cord. Although a small percentage of patients can also have short patchy lesions, about 10 to 15% of people with NMO. And that represents a big caveat to actually physicians to say that we still need to look for neuromyelitis optica, even when those lesions are small in the spinal cord. Optic nerve is often affected in a more longitudinal matter on the MRIs, and sometimes it's actually both optic nerves. And there are certain types of configurations to the lesions that we see in the brain that are very different than what we see in multiple sclerosis. So MRI with contrast, ideally, is critical for the diagnosis of neuromyelitis optica. But the diagnosis relies not only on clinical and radiological findings, but most importantly on finding the anticoagulant for antibody. And where we look for that antibody is actually the blood. So where we do see misdiagnosis quite often is a patient who presented to, say, some outside hospital and their workup was done, an aquaporin for antibody was sent and it was negative, but it was sent in the cerebrospinal fluid on the lumbar puncture, not in the blood where it needs to be sent. So that is one of the very common errors that happen still, unfortunately, and that's how the diagnosis gets delayed. The compartment that needs to be tested is the blood specifically, and it needs to be ideally tested before the high-dose steroids, plasma exchanges are given, because if we test after, then it diminishes the ability of the test to pick it up. So if you got tested after you received high-dose steroids and or plasma exchange, your doctors should be retesting you subsequently, maybe a month or a couple of months later, to see if you are indeed aquaporin 4 antibody positive. And most importantly, if you are somebody who were tested and you were negative, you would have to ask, what type of test did they use? Okay, so they tested me in the blood, but was it cell-based assay, live cell-based assay, or was it fixed cell-based assay versus ELISA? So it's a lot of technical words that, of course, nobody expects everybody to like remember. This is really more for physicians to know the subtle differences. But I would say that if you were tested with ELISA test, you should be retested via the best standard of care test, which is a live or at minimum fixed cell-based assay. So if you're negative, retesting on ELISA, retesting with a better, higher sensitivity test, which is a standard of care, is really critical. So knowing and talking to your physician what test was sent is important. And unfortunately, not all physicians are aware of these differences, and sometimes that leads to the delay of the diagnosis or misdiagnosis. And then, of course, the important thing is to rule out other conditions, right? So when people are presenting, we don't always think just about NMO or MS. We think about what else could this be, right? Could this be an infection? Could this be cancerous? Could this be something else? So the workup a lot of times, as particularly when we do the spinal tap lumbar puncture, we really are making sure there isn't an infection that's causing optic neuritis or causing transverse myelitis. So infections absolutely can do that. For example, chickenpox or like shingles can affect the optic nerve, can affect spinal cord. Herpes viruses can do the same thing. Certainly, there's a plethora of different infectious agents that can affect brain, spinal cord, and optic nerves. So excluding infections is one of the first things that we do because it's so critical, because next we have to give a patient high-dose intravenous steroids, right? And generally plasma exchange in most cases of NMO. And we want to make sure there is no infection happening at the same time, or that it could be the culprit, because certainly we would not want to give intravenous steroids to a person who is acutely infected.
Got it. That's very interesting. And it does lead me to my next question, which you already answered, but I guess if you could give me a little more detail about the acute treatments that are used during an NMOSD attack. You mentioned the intravenous steroids and plasma exchange, but can you explain what each of those are and how it's decided what treatments a patient would get?
Absolutely. Because neuromyelitis optica attacks can be so severe and so life-altering, the treatment needs to be initiated as soon as possible. So if you are a patient who has neuromyelitis optica and you think that you are having a relapse, it is critical not to just call your doctor and see if you can be seen in the next couple of days, but to actually speak to your doctor on the phone urgently. And if they are unable for some reason or unavailable to take care of you immediately or guide you to the emergency department, then you would come to the emergency department, right? Because delaying initiation of acute treatment can mean worse outcomes. So the faster we give you the treatment, the better people do long term, the higher are their chances of recovery. So typically a patient presenting with acute neuromyelitis optica attack, meaning they have a new inflammatory lesion in the brain or optic nerve or the spinal cord, which is contrast enhancing, would receive intravenous steroids, typically methylprednisolone, and they would do so for 5 days with subsequent, typically a taper of oral steroids by mouth, ranging from weeks to sometimes months, depending on some specifics. And we typically highly recommend plasma exchange. That's a filtration of your blood to get rid of the pathogenic anti-aquaporin 4 antibody. And what we know is that there's a difference in outcomes for those people who get plasma exchange versus those who don't. And also, there's a difference in outcomes when it comes to timing of the plasma exchange. So the sooner plasma exchange is given, the better people typically do, and the better are their chances of recovery. When plasma exchange is delayed by weeks or sometimes months, it certainly has a lower chance of being effective. It can still be done, but it doesn't have the same high effectiveness as it does when it's initiated quickly in the setting of an acute relapse. Now, historically, there have been people with neuromyelitis optica who present with an attack and their symptoms are actually relatively mild, and doctors give them steroids. And while they get steroids, those patients recover dramatically, nearly back to baseline or baseline. And in some of those instances, doctors historically may have bypassed plasma exchange. But the reality is that for a person who has neuromyelitis optica attack, who has moderate to severe neurological deficits, typically both steroids and plasma exchange should be given to give them the best chance of recovering or improving over time as quickly as possible.
That's good to know. And are there any adverse, I guess, effects or just side effects of either the intravenous steroids or plasma exchange that someone should be aware of?
Yeah. When we read about steroids, when patients read about steroids, people often ask, well, what about the side effects? What about increased risk of infections? What about weight gain or bloating, water retention, mood swings or sleep? And so it is true that a high dose steroids intravenously can cause some side effects, but most of them are minor and transient. And so, you know, it's always risk versus benefit. When risk is small, but the benefit is large in terms of benefit of actually treating NMO, the risk is considered to be very small. So the typical side effects that people could experience while getting intravenous steroids, some people can get flushing. They can get a little bit of heart racing. So we hydrate them, we help them calm down. Sometimes even if somebody feels extremely anxious during steroids, using a little bit of a benzodiazepine can be helpful. But people can bloat for a week or two, so retain some water. So it's not necessarily real weight gain. So just about 3 to 5 days of steroids are not going to make you gain 10 pounds. Most of it, if you did gain 5 or 10 pounds, it's probably most of it is going to be water retention. Steroids certainly increase the risk of infection. Certainly around that time, if somebody is getting intravenous steroids, most of the time they're in the hospital, right? So they're not going out and about getting infected. But even after intravenous steroids were given, and say the patient is discharged, they're typically on some oral steroid taper for at least a couple of more weeks in most cases. Those steroids are much better tolerated because they are lower doses, but they can still spike the blood sugar. So for those people who have diabetes or prediabetes, the blood sugar needs to be monitored. There needs to be a communication with the primary care doctor and the endocrinologist that you're on steroids and what's the taper doing. Because chronic steroids, meaning for more than 6 weeks, which really shouldn't be the case for people with anymore. But chronic steroids can also really thin out the bones and cause osteoporosis. Short burst of steroids typically do not have high risk of doing so, so they're pretty safe. When you get intravenous steroids, you should avoid any live or attenuated vaccines afterwards for at least a month after steroids, and generally avoid other vaccines because they are not going to be highly effective after you just gotten the intravenous steroids. You're just not going to get a good immune response. What else? There are rare complications of intravenous steroids, something called avascular hip necrosis. This is typically for people on massive doses of steroids, and that involves pain in the hip. But that is extraordinarily rare in 10 years of treating people with autoimmune conditions and neuromyelitis optica. I've maybe seen it once or twice in among thousands of patients, so it is very rare. Yeah, so those are the main side effects. Oh, and actually effects on mood and sleep, right? So when you are getting high dose IV steroids, it's very common to feel really anxious or to feel very energetic. Some people can feel nearly hypomanic, where they have so much energy, they're crawling out of their skin. This is transient. If it is to the point of severe anxiety, you should talk to your physician. They can give you some medications to help you calm during this period of time, but these effects are transient. Now, if the patient has a history of bipolar disease or severe depression, that should be verbalized to the treating physician, and those symptoms should be monitored and treated accordingly if exacerbations of depression or bipolar disease occur. That's why people who do have a history of bipolar disease or depression, if they do need steroids, really should be done in the hospital setting ideally, so they are supervised for any worsening of their mental health types of symptoms. And otherwise effects on sleep. So steroids are ideally given in the morning, because if given in the afternoon or in the evening, which sometimes happens because, say, patient arrives to the emergency department at 4 p.m. and we gotta give steroids as soon as possible. So a sleepless night can happen. So you would just have to mention to the physician that you're having difficulty sleeping, and a sleeping pill can be provided for that period of time. But this is a short-term side effect of steroids that clears once you stop steroids.
Got it. Thank you so much for going through those side effects and potential side effects, I should say. What are, so moving on from the acute setting, we know that NMOSD can potentially cause long-term effects and relapses. What are the currently available long-term therapies for NMOSD, and does this differ by location? For example, the United States versus, you know, Europe or Asia?
Yeah. In the United States, we have several FDA-approved medications. So you have Soliris, Ultomiris, which are terminal complement inhibitors. You have Uplizna, which is an anti-CD19, a B-cell depleting agent. And you also have Enspryng, also known as sartralizumab, which is a self-injectable once a month. So these are the highly effective, what we call disease-modifying treatments that are available to people living in the United States, albeit they are not available in every country elsewhere. And it gets very specific in terms of like specific countries where these things are available. But in other countries, the older mother drug, so to say, of Uplizna, if I may call it that way, rituximab is typically available. So rituximab is available, and this is also a B-cell depleting agent. It is certainly available here in the United States, and many patients are still on it, and some of them have transitioned to FDA-approved medications. But in Europe, in Asian countries, European countries, in Canada, virtually on every continent, rituximab is available for the treatment of neuromyelitis optica. Although it doesn't have a specific FDA approval here for NMO, it is certainly used off-label for decades and actually is an effective drug as well. Other medications that are available in other countries, in most countries, I would say, is tocilizumab. So tocilizumab is anti-interleukin-6 agent. It's similar to Enspryng, sartralizumab. So in some countries, and again, like there's such a long list that I would be worried about saying something is available in a specific region and it may not truly be available. But in many countries, tocilizumab, because it's an older drug, is available, and it's an infusion, and it's a drug very similar to sartralizumab, which is Enspryng. And then eculizumab, which is Soliris, is available in Europe and in some other, I believe it's available in Canada. I may be wrong, but I believe so. Yeah, so most of these medications are available widely. Certainly, all what comes into question is the insurance coverage. So that gets really tricky, particularly in European countries who also have very strict sort of preferences for what medication needs to be initiated first.
Great. Thank you so much. So we had a question from a community member. They ask, I have a lesion on the thoracic level of my spine from NMO affecting my whole lower body. Will high levels of vitamin B12 help heal my myelin sheath and aid in nerve regeneration? They said someone suggested B12 supplements 2 times a day with levels 125,000% RDA. They say they are not on rituximab treatment.
Certainly, B12 is critical for myelin, so is folate. But currently, there are no data to suggest that high-dose vitamin B12 would be helpful in remyelination specifically. However, what I would say is that it is, for me, it is the standard of care when I have patients with neuromyelitis optica or other diseases that affect brain, spinal cord, optic nerves. I typically always check B12 because some people are actually at a very low level. And so when you are at a very low level, then yes, you do need to take a supplement. So we typically want the levels of B12 to be above 300, because if you are below, true deficiency is below 180, but below 300, that's, we consider it insufficient. So if you're insufficient or deficient, yes, that's not going to help remyelinate, right? So we actually do want more vitamin B12 on board. But vitamin B12 is also one of those vitamins that is water soluble. So that means that your body can only use what it needs. And if you give massive amounts of B12 to your body, you're just going to basically lose it through the urine. So you're going to pee it out. But to summarize, while B12 supplementation has a role, particularly for those people who are deficient or insufficient in vitamin B12, really super high doses of vitamin B12 do not seem to have a significant amount of data to suggest that they aid in remyelination.
Great. Thank you for answering that. We had another person write in. I'm not sure that they have NMO, but chronic optic neuritis. They ask if there have been any breakthrough treatments for chronic optic neuritis.
Yeah, I'm not sure what is meant by chronic optic neuritis, because in neuromyelitis optica, optic neuritis is typically not chronic. It's acute, and then the inflammation goes away. In some instances, we know that enhancement or basically, leakiness of the contrast on the MRI can persist in some people with optic neuritis, even though their symptoms have resolved or are stable. And we actually do not call it chronic optic neuritis. But if the person means chronic optic neuritis as recurrent optic neuritis, the best strategies are still prevention. Now, there are some people who truly have chronic optic neuritis and that's generally not neuromyelitis optica. So chronic optic neuritis or smoldering, ongoing inflammation of optic nerve, most of the time we have to think about diseases like neurosarcoidosis or IgG4-related disease or some paraneoplastic disorders. But neuromyelitis optica per se should not have an ongoing chronic inflammation along optic nerve over months or years. When it happens, it typically resolves, and then there's a static period in between unless there's another attack on the optic nerve again.
Okay, thank you so much. Another person asked, how can they successfully appeal insurance to continue physical and occupational therapies for a patient with significant deficits due to NMOSD relapses?
Yeah, this is certainly very challenging. And there isn't a one specific way to do it, but I think that your doctor, your neurologist should be your best advocate, because what they're able to do and what I do for my patients is basically collect all the data on the importance of physical and occupational therapy for people with neuromyelitis optica, make a copy of those papers, look at the statistics, I highlight them, and I send it to the insurance company saying that, hey, my patient needs it, they're going to benefit from it. And when it's denied, going through an appeal and escalating to the medical director, and then sometimes even escalating to the external appeal. So this is more so on your, you know, it's on your physician to advocate for you and utilize the research articles that show benefit and fight for you.
Thank you so much. And I know this is a big issue that many of our community members do face, unfortunately, at least here in the United States. So I appreciate your perspective and encourage everyone who is needing their neurologist to be, you know, their support in something like insurance appeals, to really advocate for yourself in that setting. And also, if it's not working out with your neurologist, to try and see if you can find a better fit with someone who is willing to fight for you. So thank you for that answer. We have someone ask that they feel they're exhibiting symptoms such as a ring of stiffness and pain around the waist and lower back, as if someone has carried you off the floor holding you at the waist. What kind of symptom would you describe that as, and what kind of medication is usually prescribed for that kind of symptom?
When I hear stiffness and pain around the lower back, I always want to make sure that it's truly related to neuromyelitis optica. Certainly, if the patient had a lesion, a transverse myelitis in that area, in the lower thoracic spinal cord, and that's their typical symptoms, that they have a lot of pain and stiffness, there we will use medications like muscle relaxants for stiffness. So things like baclofen, tizanidine. For nerve-related pain, we will use medications like pregabalin, Lyrica, gabapentin, which is Neurontin, and also duloxetine, Cymbalta. But there are some other medications that can be utilized as well. In cases where the pain does not respond to medication management, certainly sometimes acupuncture can be helpful. But in severe cases, we employ pain management doctors to step up on the medication management. And where all medication management fails, if it does, then spinal cord stimulators for pain control can be done via a neurosurgical consultation. But as a neurologist, when I hear a patient tell me about low back pain and stiffness, I also want to make sure that it's not the lumbar spine, that there isn't like a badly slipped disc or stenosis, narrowing in the low back pain. Because the truth is, for people with neuromyelitis optica and for people with MS, when people who are having symptoms, a lot of times it just gets attributed to their disease without sometimes investigating for what else could this be. So if somebody had low back pain and it was worsening, I would say, sure, I'll check the MRI, a spinal cord in terms of neuromyelitis optica, but I'm also going to take a look at your lumbar spine. There is no spinal cord there. There's nerve roots going into your legs, but low back pain often comes from the lumbar spine because of a degenerative disc disease or a narrowing in the lumbar spine, and that can cause a lot of chronic pain and stiffness as well.
Great, thank you. Someone asked, what considerations should someone diagnosed with NMOSD have who is thinking of family planning?
This is a very important question. I think that I will tell you what I tell my patients. In general, because neuromyelitis optica tends to be so active during the first couple of years of diagnosis, I tell my patients to try and stabilize your disease for at least 2 years before trying to conceive. And in terms of medications, not all medications can be continued during pregnancy. So you would have to talk to your physician about your specific medication that you are on and how to time it around the pregnancy so that your baby is not exposed. And then how quickly should you get back on the medicine after you have the baby and discuss the considerations about breastfeeding. So on some of these medications, breastfeeding should not be done. On at least one of them, it can be done. And also have a discussion with your physician about pregnancy, the actual pregnancy planning. So if there was a relapse during pregnancy, what would be the treatment? Would it be steroids? What else can be done? For older medications like rituximab, there certainly have been cases, and for many physicians, some patients had rituximab and then shortly after became pregnant and had their baby safely. And we never have seen any kind of birth defects or issues on babies exposed to rituximab. But babies exposed to rituximab, particularly if the exposure was later in the pregnancy, sometimes can have low white blood cell counts that self-resolve over the next couple of months. Sometimes their neutrophils can become low. That's a subset of immune cells. And so those things become important for babies' vaccines. So in some instances, for a patient who has highly active neuromyelitis optica and the doctors are really concerned about potential relapses during pregnancy, some doctors historically have dosed rituximab shortly prior to the pregnancy and sometimes even during pregnancy. This has been done. There's some medical literature on that, and virtually every person who treats neuromyelitis optica has some experience with that. Having said that, certainly there is no FDA approval for this medication or any medication for the use in pregnancy. So these decisions are tough ones, and they have to be discussed with your physician based on, you know, how well you have done in terms of controlling your neuromyelitis optica. Have you had any recent relapses? And that's why I say that ideally you should stabilize your disease for at least 2 years, no relapses for at least 2 years before you try to conceive. And we do that as to minimize the risk of relapse during pregnancy.
Great. Thank you. Those are important considerations. And I think anyone who is considering family planning should definitely have a conversation with their neurologist to start off and start having those conversations. Is there ever a time when a long-term therapy can be weaned off? If I haven't had an attack in several years, should I come off treatment? Also, are there negatives to staying on a treatment long-term, 10 plus years?
Yeah, no, thank you. This is such an important question. What we know is that the vast majority of people with neuromyelitis optica have a relapsing disease, and the ephemeral concept of monophasic NMO disease is barely existent. So most people do require long-term treatment to prevent attacks. And absolutely, we see people that have been stable for 10, 15 years and then can still have an attack. We see sometimes, I will cite an example, a person who is on CellCept or mycophenolate mofetil, stable for 10, 12 years. And let's say that the physician has a difficult time convincing them to go onto an FDA-approved medication that is actually better in controlling the disease and preventing relapses, say Aplizna or Enspryng or Celeris or Ultomiris. So, you know, that person on CellCept, even when they're 60s or 70s, can still have a relapse. So in the real world, we all have had patients, including myself, where we've seen a relapse in somebody who was already so much older, sometimes in their 60s or 70s, who has been stable for 10 or 15 years, particularly on some of those non-FDA lower efficacy drugs, and then they relapse on that drug. So unfortunately, people can continue to have relapses even at the extremes of the age group. So we do see it sometimes even in 70-year-olds. So I would stay on the treatment And then the second part of the question, forgive me, I didn't answer it. What are the long-term side effects? Every medication has side effects, and it's always about risk versus benefit. If the risk is small, but the benefit is keeping you neurologically intact and preventing severe optic neuritis or transverse myelitis or even rare, more severe complications like becoming a ventilator dependent, which is something that certainly everybody is afraid of with neuromyelitis optica. Small side effects or low risk side effects are typically tolerated well. So for most of these medications, slightly increased risk of infections or modestly increased risk of infections for some is an issue. So that's why there are several medications available. So if the person is not doing well on one of the medications and is having frequent infections, perhaps a switch is warranted, right? After a discussion with your physician to a different medication. But for most of these medications, risk of infections is the one key side effect that we think about. Certainly, some of them are safer in terms of risk of infections than the others. But then in terms of long-term side effects, so none of these medications that are FDA approved are really known to cause major long-term side effects, such as increased cancer rates, for example. That's generally not the sort of the risk of things like B-cell depleting agents or anti-interleukin-6 agents or complement inhibition. That is not the typical risk, right? Because some of these medications have been used for a long time for other disorders with hundreds of thousands of people and similar drugs around the world. So typically, increased risk of cancers is not a concern with the FDA-approved medications for NMO. The older medications like CellCept, mycophenolate, Mofetil, azathioprine that are actually less effective and they are non-FDA approved. They are used off-label, were used off-label before better medications became available. On those medications, they do carry a warning of slightly increased risk of malignancies over the long term of immunosuppression. But otherwise, the medications like Soliris, Ultomiris, Uplizna, Enspryng, while on some of them, we monitor the liver enzymes, right? While you may see some liver enzyme elevations on one or two of them, typically these are not the drugs that are hepatotoxic or really toxic to the liver. So occasionally we see liver enzyme elevations on some of them and we basically see if it just self-resolves on its own. For most of the time, that's the case. Or sometimes it has actually nothing to do with the drug itself. It may be an autoimmune liver disease or it may be a fatty liver disease or we find something else that's causing it. But generally speaking, for most FDA-approved treatments, risk of infections would be the side effect that your physicians hopefully is discussing with you and sort of preventive strategies for the infections and the importance of investigating infectious symptoms and treating infections quickly as to prevent more severe disease.
Great. Thank you so much. We got two kind of similar questions or on the same topic, I should say, about behavioral and psychological changes after diagnosis or personality changes. So can you kind of shed light on like the timeline of, is that behavior normal to experience right after diagnosis, but what's the prognosis? Will someone return back to the way they were before their attack? And what kind of behavioral and psychological changes are associated with NMOSD?
Sure. I think this is an important question. I think that generally people experience the concept of disease very differently. For some people, when they have their first attack on the diagnosis, there appears to be no strong association with depression or anxiety. For others, they may experience depressive symptoms, severe anxiety, trouble sleeping, and that, of course, can cause changes in the personality. So the disease itself, the inflammation itself, really shouldn't be causing changes in personality. But the perception of what you as a human being are going through in the concept of the disease and the diagnosis and the stress of healthcare and the stress of learning about the disease and the medications while you're trying to recover, while you are trying to go through physical therapy, that is an incredible amount of stress that can take a huge toll on people's emotional health and does affect the behavior. So it is very common that we see people that go through what we call adjustment disorder due to medical illness. This is adjustment disorder due to medical illness is usually feelings of depression due to their diagnosis or their neurological issues that happen to, secondary to disease. Also, anxiety about what does the future hold for me? How will I do? Will I have another attack? Will this medication work? What are the side effects? I'm reading and I'm so scared. So depression and anxiety are very common. Typically, they're short-lived and we call them adjustment disorder due to medical illness. But absolutely, they can cause personality changes by disrupting sleep, by robbing you of the energy. And because depression alone can rob somebody of energy, not just neuromyelitis optica, when inflammation can cause fatigue as well. Absolutely. But it's almost like a vicious cycle of fatigue due to the inflammation, but also if you're feeling down and depressed, that can also cause more fatigue. And if that person is having trouble sleeping, that's going to worsen the fatigue. That can create a lot of brain fog, particularly if you're not sleeping or your sleep is interrupted. So for those people who suffer from nerve pain, for those people who suffer from bladder issues with emptying the bladder or having to use the bathroom nonstop, that affects the sleep. And when the sleep is affected, the mood is going to be affected. When the mood and sleep are affected, personality changes. People can become more depressed or more irritable. Also, when we think about depression, depression manifests itself very differently in different people. Some people may have low appetite. Some people can basically can't stop eating. Some people can't sleep at all. Some people, all they want to do is sleep. Some people are just sad and they have crying spells. And some people become more hostile or more irritable and really sometimes even can go into rage. So there are differences in how depression is experienced sometimes between individuals and sometimes between different genders. So I think that at the time of the diagnosis of neuromyelitis optica, it is common to see this, and the key to this is to make sure that the neuroimmunology doctor who is treating for you for neuromyelitis optica is somebody who you connect with, who can explain, who can provide reassurance and answers in a language that you understand, that you feel that the doctor is available if you have more questions. A lot of times we'll tell our patients to grab a video appointment with us if you have more questions, because having neuromyelitis optica is a very lonely place because it is so rare and there are very few people that have it. As much support from your physician that you can get, you really need it. A lot of support comes through just education about the neuromyelitis optica, joining support community where through we are SRNA or Samira Foundation can be helpful as well. But then also making sure that your physician is talking to you about your sleep and your emotional health. And there are certainly psychotherapy and medications, at least transiently for depressive symptoms and anxiety that can be utilized. So sometimes setting up with a neuropsychiatrist can be helpful. Setting up an appointment with neuropsychiatrist can be also helpful as well. Meanwhile, many neurologists will prescribe medications to help manage anxiety and depression and then have you set up with neuropsychiatry colleagues as well. Clinical psychologists can be very helpful as well. So like I said, support groups. But most important is your relationship with your treating physician, because you, in this disease, it is particularly critical to have a physician who hears you, who understands you, who explains well, who provides resources, and who advocates for you.
Great. Thank you so much. And that's great advice. Appreciate you sharing. So we do have 10 minutes left, so I'm going to try and get through
A few more questions. If anyone who's joining us live right now has a last minute question for Dr. G, please feel free to put it in the chat or in the Q&A and we'll try and get to it. So someone did ask if there are any trials available for Aquaphor for negative patients.
This is something that I think the entire research community is working towards, because Aquaporin for negative neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder previously, and now we're going to be calling it neuromyelitis optica clinical syndromes based on the updated neuromyelitis optica criteria, diagnostic criteria. It's going to be called double seronegative neuromyelitis optica clinical syndrome, and it recognizes people who have had symptoms or attacks similar to people who are aquaporin 4 antibody positive neuromyelitis optica. But there's also more and more recognition of the fact that these two diseases are very distinctly different. So the biomarkers between those people who are seronegative neuromyelitis optica or clinical syndromes versus aquaporin 4 positive, they are different. And their outcomes are different when it comes to clinical trials as well. So the challenges of designing clinical trials for people who are seronegative, who are neuromyelitis optica clinical syndromes, is based on the fact that that term is an umbrella for people who may have very different underlying pathologies or actual diseases. That's why they don't respond to treatments equally as well as people who are aquaporin 4 antibody positive. So those clinical trials are challenging because they encompass people with variable disease pathologies. Until we have better biomarkers to understand the more unique features of the people who are aquaporin 4 negative and MOG negative, but neuromyelitis optica spectrum clinical syndromes, it is difficult truly to design trials that provide really good definitive information.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. And just a note on the revised clinical guidelines that you mentioned. We will have more information about that hopefully in the coming month or two, so that we could share more about those new guidelines with all of you in more detail. We have a question. Do chances of relapse increase with age?
No, not that we are seeing in general population. In people who are stable on a medication, there is no data to suggest that getting older increases your risk of relapse.
Great. Thank you. How often should I see my neurologist after diagnosis and initial treatment?
Typically, for patients who are taking chronic medications, like maybe they are on Uplizna or Enspryng or on Soliris or Ultomiris, the standard of care is that patients should be seen every 6 months, but how often you specifically should be seen also depends on what's going on, right? So for a person who had their attack, received IV steroids and plasma exchange, and they actually had a very nice recovery with minimal residual symptoms, that person certainly can just see their physician every 6 months and otherwise is needed. But there are patients who have incomplete or poor recovery, and they are still suffering from a lot of nerve-related pain or a lot of muscle spasms or stiffness, spasticity, bladder issues. Those patients should be seeing the physician ideally more frequently. Typically, after you've been discharged from the hospital, the expectation is that you should be seen within a month. And then based on that assessment, say if your physician is still trying to get your pain under control and your stiffness or muscle spasms under control, a lot of times we'll have a short follow-up within 3 to 4 weeks or within 6 weeks, and then go from there depending on how well your symptoms are controlled. So there isn't like a specific guideline as to how often you should be seen. It's really guided by how well you are doing and if the symptoms are under control. So for some of my patients whose symptoms are not under good control, I might be seeing them every month for the first 3 to 4 months. There are also patients that are struggling with the concept of the diagnosis and the fear of what's to come. So for those patients, we do suggest that they actually see us during the first couple of months more frequently so that we can be there to support them and answer questions and help hopefully calm some of those fears. But otherwise, if somebody is stable, we typically see them every 6 months and in between as needed by them. And that's really just driven by the patient if they have some sort of questions or they are concerned about something.
Great. Thank you. I think we have time for probably one, maybe two more questions. We got a few different questions about relapses, so I'll try and summarize them into one. Are effects from a relapse permanent, such as vision loss or those acute symptoms someone experiences during the relapse, are they permanent? And what are the chances of fully recovering after a relapse?
I think that this is a question of statistics, but I think that statistics are unfair when it comes to a specific individual because NMO affects everybody differently and people have different severity of the disease and the treatment that's initiated is initiated at different points. Some people get treatment very quickly, like intravenous steroids and plasma exchange. Some people get treatment with a delay of many days or hopefully not weeks. Some people may have never received plasma exchange, right? So there's a lot of variables and also variables such as age, right? So we know that younger people, for example, tend to recover better than older. It's most people when they are recovering, most of the recovery is typically seen within the first 3 months or so, or with more recovery that can be seen slowly up to a full year. But the degree of the recovery really depends, number one, on the severity of the attack. So people with severe attacks with complete loss of vision at times have more poor recovery. People with milder loss of vision often have better recovery simply because the damage that was done clearly is not as severe as in those people who have had more severe vision loss. But definitely the timing to the medication and the timing to the plasma exchange is very meaningful in these instances. And so the faster people get treatment and particularly plasma exchange for severe attack, the better they tend to do. But the first 3 months is the sort of the time when we see most of the people recover due to most of the recovery, but some more recovery at a lower pace can occur up to a full year typically.
Great. Thank you so much. And I think that's a good place to land on to end this conversation, but I do appreciate you spending the time with us today and answering so many of our questions. And I'm hoping to continue the conversation again. I know we can always keep learning and keep doing more of these info sessions. Thank you so much, Dr. G.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you to our Ask the Expert sponsors, Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, and Genentech. Amgen is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Amgen believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal is to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist, and they are committed to ensuring that patient perspective and community engagement are always at the forefront of their work. Founded more than 40 years ago, Genentech is a leading biotechnology company that discovers, develops, manufactures, and commercializes medicines to treat patients with serious and life-threatening medical conditions. The company, a member of the Roche Group, has headquarters in South San Francisco, California. For additional information about the company, please visit www.gene.com.